The data are not supporting what the advocates are arguing.
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate.
The Republican take on climate change, will it shift by 2016? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
It's not too cumbersome. The suit's pretty flexible. It just gets a little hot inside.
You ferment it, dry it, and then roast it.
You have to be on point every single day.
They want that medication. They use the coupon. But then the coupon goes away.
I want to eat more of this.
That substance
and I don't
want
to move at all. I just want to sit around. And that's a problem.
Putting the word chemical on something that can make it scary out of it.
On today's show, getting to know the most distant stars, cool red giants, and a tiny dot on a woman's tongue with big implications. But first up, President Obama's landmark carbon reduction agreement with China this week was criticized by Republican leaders, including Mitch McConnell, who said it puts too much onus on the United States and doesn't demand enough from China. With Republicans in control of Congress and climate change now playing a major role in both domestic and foreign policy, Carolyn Beeler has a look at what the Republican Party's stance on climate change is likely to be in the 2016 presidential election.
The GOP line on climate change before the midterm elections was repeated often enough to end up as the butt of a joke on the Colbert Report.
I'm not a scientist, nor am I a physicist.
I'm not qualified to debate the science over climate change.
I'm not a scientist.
I'm not a scientist.
What I have said repeatedly is I'm not a scientist.
Yes, everyone who denies man-made climate change has the same stirring message. We don't know what the f*** we're talking about.
Colbert doesn't hide his derision, but climate activists like David Goldston from the Natural Resources Defense Council Action Fund actually see this election's catchphrase as a step forward.
The I am not a scientist is clearly kind of a defensive crouch that they've been pushed into because denying the science has turned out not to be an acceptable political position.
That's something of a change. In recent years, climate denial has been the go-to stance for Tea Party Republicans, but the issue hasn't been a major player at the ballot box. In the last presidential election, Anthony Leiserwitz says climate change didn't even come up in the debates.
In 2014, however, we saw that the issue finally became an issue in many of the most hotly contested races.
Leiserwitz directs the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication. Amid Obama's landmark carbon deal with China, a 2015 international climate summit, and expected battles in Congress on the president's Clean Power Plan rule, climate issues are likely to garner even more attention in 2016 than they did in the midterms. Whether the GOP develops its own proactive climate change platform by then, though, will come down to who gets the nomination, Leiserwitz says.
Essentially, you can think of this as the debate between the establishment Republican Party and the Tea Party. The establishment has largely accepted that climate change is real and a serious problem and needs some sort of policy action.
Meanwhile, the Tea Party has forced many members of the GOP who long championed climate change legislation, like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, to backtrack on their positions. Some Republicans say now is the time to reverse that trend. One of those is former South Carolina Representative Bob Inglis. Inglis served for a dozen years before being booted out of Washington in 2010 for what he calls the heresy of believing in climate change. He thinks the GOP needs to revamp a retro climate attitude.
Now, that retro affect surely fit the Great Recession because we were mad. We were mad about our houses plummeting in value. We were mad about losing our jobs. We were upset. And so it's natural that we went to what we knew, comfort food, comfort coal, comfort oil.
But now, as the recession lifts, Inglis says,
that's going to look oh so very Great Recession as a style. And so I think that the presidential contenders will want to reposition and move away from that grumpy old party affect.
In 2011, Inglis started the Energy and Enterprise Initiative to push for a conservative climate change solution.
We think that the best way to do that is through what's called a revenue-neutral, border-adjustable carbon tax. Now, that deserves some unpacking, doesn't it?
Revenue-neutral means if there's a carbon tax,
then we've got to cut taxes somewhere else so there's no growth of government.
And border adjustable means removing the tax from exports and adding it to imports from countries that don't themselves tax carbon. Other prominent Republicans, including former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and former Secretary of State George P. Shultz, back versions of carbon taxes, though one couldn't pass in this Congress. Where the GOP ultimately lands on climate change come 2016 will hinge on who gets the nomination, says the NRDC's David Goldston.
There's going to be a civil war to some extent within the Republican Party about what line to take.
Bob Inglis, for one, is optimistic. Just as Nixon went to China and Clinton passed welfare reform, he argues the country would only trust a Republican president to address climate change. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. They are called cool red giants, the most distant stars in our galaxy. They are so far away, it just boggles the mind. You need 18 zeros behind the number of miles they are away from the Earth. But John Bochansky, a professor of physics at Rider University near Trenton, New Jersey, found them anyway. And he's joining us now to talk about his process. John, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thank you.
So I read in your research that the closest star to Earth is about 3 light years away, and the further one of the 2 stars your team found is 900,000 light-years away. But can you put it in terms that we can understand?
Yeah. So really, really, really far. Another way that I like to talk about it is that when the light from that star left the star on its way to our telescopes here on Earth, the people on Earth were just really figuring out how to light fire for the first time. So it was 900,000 years ago. It's a bit mind-boggling.
And why are these most distant stars called cool red giants?
Those are the last stages for the evolution of a star like our sun. Our sun's going to turn into a red giant in about 5 billion years or so. And what happens as a star ages, it cools, and so that's why they appear red when we look at them through a telescope. But they also expand. And as the outer layers expand, the star emits a lot more light than a star like our sun. So anywhere from about 10,000 to a million times more photons are being produced every second. And so these things can be seen at tremendously large distances.
And how did we know they were there?
Well, we didn't. We knew that we had data that was accessible to us that if they were there, they would show up in this database. And so astronomy is really now in an era of large surveys. If somebody tried to do this project 30 years ago, it would have taken a lot of time at the telescope, a lot of nights, lonely nights sitting up on the telescope. Now, I can go to the internet and download information on tens of millions of stars. So that's exactly what we did.
So you can take data from what the telescope has seen, but you didn't have to be there to see it.
Exactly. Yeah. So there were 2 large surveys that have looked at, combined, they've looked at about a tenth of the sky where they overlap, because that gave us the most information. We were able to use that information to sort through and find the most distant stars in that catalog.
So what exactly did you find?
So we started off with about 6 million candidates.
That were far away, but you wanted them to be the furthest away, or what?
Yeah, so the 6 million had the right colors. They were red. And depending on the filter combination, we have a lot of different filters that we use to look at these stars. So we take light in blue light, red light, green light, in the infrared, we combine all that information, and we went from about 6 million down to about 1,600. Then it was time to go to the telescope. And by taking very detailed observations, we obtained spectra. And so essentially what we're doing is pointing the telescope at the star, spreading the light out in order to identify that the star really was a bona fide distant red giant.
And then what?
And then we celebrate. So we went and observed. This was last November, actually, but the campaign has been ongoing. Myself and another astronomer from Boston, we went to the Mount Hopkins Observatory out near Tucson, Arizona. And we had about 20 stars that were our best candidates. And over the course of 3 nights, we obtained these detailed observations, and we were able to identify a few of these really distant red giants.
So these findings are cool and awesome. Yeah. But what can we do with this information? What will come of this?
Right. So the main, scientific application for the discovery of these stars is that the models that do the best job of predicting the formation and the evolution of our galaxy don't really predict large numbers of stars at these distances. And so right now we only have a few that we know of that are really, really far out there. And so what myself and my team are going to continue to do is search for these things and try and put a handle on the statistics behind them. So if we continue to find more at these large distances, then we know that the models should really be revised and revisited.
Now, with the stars you discovered or helped discover, mm-hmm. do you get to name them?
Unfortunately not. Ah. They have very boring names. The names of these two stars we shortened to ULAS, J0015, and 0744. ULAS, ULAS, stands for the survey that initially took the data. And then the numbers just correspond to the latitude and longitude on the sky.
What would you have named them, or one of them anyway?
That's a good question. I think since my wife is here, maybe Alien Star for the most distant one.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Mikan.
John Bochansky is a professor of physics at Rider University. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott. People who have a serious illness often say they don't remember the moment of diagnosis, what their doctor said, how they said it, and what they should do next. And some of them say they felt their doctor wasn't really all that helpful or kind. But doctors really struggle with these situations too. And as a result, important conversations and decisions may not happen. For about 2 decades, Dr. Bob Arnold of the University of Pittsburgh, along with some colleagues, has been honing in on ways to change this and to help doctors become better communicators. He was recently in Philadelphia and led a very intimate training with oncologists from around the region. Alana Gordon was there and has this report.
Chris Martinez is 45 years old and he has lymphoma. He's been through chemo and he's had a stem cell transplant. He hunches ever so slightly in his chair and presses his hands between his legs. He wants to be cancer-free.
How much time do I have if I stop the chemo? If I stop now?
Yeah. Honestly, I think that we're probably looking at a matter of weeks, either with or without the chemo.
This is what you might call a tough conversation. Really tough. Dr. Amy McKenzie gently leans in.
Yeah, I'm really sorry.
That's no time.
Now, I should probably tell you that Martinez is not actually a real patient. He's an actor, Alan Riblett, and this is not actually Dr. McKenzie's office. The two are in one of those drafty, carpeted conference rooms in a hotel on the outskirts of Philadelphia. Oh, and they're not alone.
Where is he, emotion or facts?
Emotion.
So don't ask, how can...
Dr. Bob Arnold of the University of Pittsburgh has called a timeout. He's leading a training and sees that McKenzie is getting stuck.
This isn't what you wanted to hear.
Yeah.
What else?
Arnold is intense but informal. He's not wearing his shoes, and he has on bright, striped socks.
Just attending to the emotion.
Arnold and some colleagues from the University of Washington and Duke have spent the last 2 decades trying to figure out how to improve doctor communication skills. They designed this training called Vital Talk. Arnold says it centers on learning how to recognize emotion in that exam room and playing off it through different communication techniques so it can lead to more meaningful conversations.
If I give you information and you're really emotionally overwhelmed, you don't hear it. And then you come in the next day and you ask it again and I'm sort of frustrated.
Everyone loses. Arnold says emotions may also reflect what's most important to patients and indicate what doctors really need to address in that visit. He says doctors, for the most part, are not trained in this. Palliative care is starting to address it, but he wants to create an entire culture shift in medicine. His goal is to train half of all oncologists in the U.S. If he's able to do that, he thinks meaningful conversations could become the norm and lead to better care.
Everyone sort of talks about how their doctor knows the latest stuff. We want them also to say, my doctor really listens to me. My doctor really gets where I am. My doctor, I feel like I can talk to my doctor about the really tough stuff that I'm confronting. What else can you say attending to the emotion?
You seem really upset.
This isn't what you wanted to hear.
Inside that conference room, Arnold and five other clinicians sit in a semicircle around Mackenzie and Martinez, the fake patient. They all offer feedback to whichever one of them is up front in that hot seat.
You're doing great. You just need to hang with him. As he, like, he came in and thinking that he might get you to say it was curable.
During this timeout, Mackenzie is trying to figure out how to make a plan for Martinez now that he really knows his prognosis. Arnold encourages her to wait and just be with him. He says this approach may actually save time and lead to more productive conversations. They reset and try again, picking up at that moment where Martinez learns he has just a few weeks left.
I don't know how this happened. I don't believe it.
This time, instead of chiming in to ask about what she can do to come up with a plan, Mackenzie just sits with him and his emotions. About 15 seconds pass. The room is totally still. And then he asks,
what do I do?
What do I do? He brings it up.
He'll get there. You just have to sit with it. Perfect.
Arnold ends the role play. Now, he says, the patient is ready. He's in a place where he and Mackenzie are on the same page, and together they can map out those next steps.
So what's the take-home point for you?
Stop. Just stop. Have patience. I have a tendency to just want to push forward and do.
In general, that works well for us. It works well as an oncologist and as a nurse practitioner in oncology. It helps you get through the day. It helps you feel good.
Right.
And just sometimes it doesn't move forward. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, sir.
It was really intense. It was really intense.
Mackenzie says this might have been a role play, but she encounters situations like this all the time as an oncologist at Thomas Jefferson University. It's hard to come up with the words, she says.
We want to fix people, and you know, if we can't fix their cancer, we want to fix their other problems. And I don't think patients always want to be fixed. I think sometimes they just want to be heard.
Mackenzie says this exercise helped set in motion that realization. She says it means a lot because tomorrow, when she and others are back at work, there won't be any timeouts, no resets, just one shot, one chance with a patient in a conversation that could be one of the most important defining ones of their life. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Coming up on The Pulse, it may look like grass, but is artificial turf made with shredded tires safe?
We only know that we can't put our tires out on in our garbage or on the curb to be picked up. And now we're about to put our kids out on that same material, and that does not make sense to me.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. IBC believes in living like nothing can hold you down. But to live worry-free, you need someone to fall back on. With doctors and hospitals across the region, Independence Blue Cross is here to help. This year, you may be eligible for financial support designed to help you live fearless. More information at IBX.com or 1-800-ASK-BLUE. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca promotes health and science education and disease awareness through initiatives such as the Young Health Program, which helps young people build personal qualities to live healthy, successful lives. Launched in the U.S. in partnership with the United Way of Delaware, the Young Health Program has reached nearly 12,000 young people since 2012. More about the Young Health Program can be found online at im40.org.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Artificial turf has gotten a lot better in recent years. It looks like grass, it feels like grass, and it's easy to maintain. But there are some potential health concerns, and some of them sound pretty scary.
Our NBC News investigation, how safe is the artificial turf on the fields children are playing on across our country? Is there a potential health risk? Tonight, a coach who knows...
Artificial turf's been around for quite some time, so why don't we know more about this? Laura Benchoff reports.
Spectators cluster under umbrellas during a rainy high school football game. The Palumbo Academy Griffins are taking on the Prep Charter Huskies on South Philly's Supersite, one of four shared-use synthetic fields owned by the school district.
Too hot! So hot! Too hot! Woo! We get the fake!
Synthetic turf is essentially a carpet of fake grass, sprinkled with a liberal amount of tire crumb, made from shredded recycled tires, which props up the blades and cushions impact. They call this infill. Turf installers say it costs less to maintain, uses less water, and holds up for longer hours than natural grass. An average athletic field can contain over 20,000 recycled tires, and there are at least 8,000 of these fields across North America.
It just doesn't seem like anybody's connecting the dots in terms of chemicals and exposures.
Kelly Frosch is a ward commissioner in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania, which recently voted to replace the athletic fields in the town park with artificial turf fields. Frosch cast the only dissenting vote. She said the material safety data sheet provided by the company that manufactures the fields, called Vasco Sports, raised some red flags. Here she is reading from one of these sheets at a commissioner's meeting on July 8th.
Lung injury and cancer hazard. Do not breathe the dust. May cause delayed lung injury. Long-term exposure can cause celiosis.
According to the EPA's own reports, known carcinogens like benzene and butylated hydroxyanisole have been identified in some tires. And Frosch said Vasco's own representatives seemed oblivious to potential health impacts.
I had one of them say to me, because I said, I've heard these can be flammable. And he said, oh, we took care of that. Now we spray them with flame retardants. And I just looked at him for a second and I said, didn't we start removing those out of clothing material? Because they were possibly harmful to children.
Child safety is a sticking point for Frosch and other parents who want information on the potential link between turf and cancer. Enter public health toxicologist David Brown of the nonprofit Environment and Human Health Incorporated, or EHHI.
We work on orphan public health problems, and that's what brought us to the turf question.
He says a lot of the studies done in this country on the health impacts of turf haven't gotten at the cancer question, because what they tested didn't replicate how people actually spend time on these fields.
I saw a risk assessment that was done, I think, in California, where the assumption was that a child would play on the field once in their lifetime, and the risk would be very small. The actual potential ingestion that a child would get is what you need to know before you can determine whether it's safe or not.
I reached out to the EPA by phone and email for comment. They said they're evaluating a request by New Jersey Representative Frank Pallone to do more research on potential health impacts and pointed me to existing studies on their website. The studies I found there are limited and did not explicitly explore a link with cancer. Brown at EHHI says that's an oversight.
There were high cancer rates in the tire manufacturing industry. Nothing essentially has happened in these tires other than that the chemicals become more available once you put them into playgrounds and crumb rubber.
Brown says the high incidence rate of the same kinds of cancers, the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas seen in some soccer goalies, points to a specific chemical carcinogen. But drawing that link would require resources and governmental oversight on a scale that hasn't been happening at the state and local level.
Because this is a recreational waste, the decision was made that the health decisions would be placed at the level of the state and local governments. They can't do it.
Which isn't to say they haven't done studies. The Synthetic Turf Council's website lists 14 it says show that turf
doesn't pose a serious health hazard to users. This includes a study last year out of Rutgers University, funded by the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. That study put small amounts of crumb rubber, 200 milligrams or less than a packet of sugar, in artificial biofluids to see what potentially harmful compounds spit or stomach acid could pull out. What substances they did find were not enough to cause concern. But that study simulated only one exposure and sampled only 7 pre-existing fields across New Jersey. The New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection is also the entity responsible for disposing of tires in the state.
One of the problems is that the people who are making the decisions are people in local communities and in local towns and local governments. And they're making a decision with data that's inadequate.
Which brings us back to local officials like Commissioner Kelly Frosch, who have to decide what's an acceptable risk for their town.
We only know that we can't put our tires out on in our garbage or on the curb to be picked up. And now we're about to put our kids out on that same material. And that does not make sense to me.
Cities from San Francisco, California to Ocean City, New Jersey are struggling with similar concerns, and some have halted plans for artificial turf fields. Frosch has introduced a motion to use a non-tire-based infill for Mount Lebanon's fields. A decision is due November 28th. For The Pulse, I'm Laura Benshoff.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You've heard of smart boards, right? Interactive plasma display, touchscreen, and so on. Old news. Check this out. Villanova University recently opened a new interactive classroom called The Cave. The whole thing is made for 3D learning. It uses high-tech software and high-resolution projectors. Picture field trips to the bottom of the ocean or a tour of the human brain. Todd Bookman has more.
To picture what the cave looks like, picture a box you can step inside of.
18 feet across by 10 feet deep by 7.5 feet high. All of it's screen.
Frank Klassner is happy to show off his enclosure, which can comfortably fit a dozen or so people. The Villanova computer science professor spearheaded the project, helping to secure a $1.6 million National Science Foundation grant. He also happens to look good in the glasses users wear. They're similar to what you put on at a 3D movie, but the effect is very different.
It's not like you would get an IMAX or a traditional 3D movie because the projectors are surrounding you. They're not just in front of you. So as you turn your head, infrared cameras around this enclosure, they're tracking your head motion and adjusting the display accordingly.
Along with the depth and clarity of the images on the screen, users have the ability to control the display. Klassner pulls up pictures of Mars taken the day before by NASA's Curiosity rover. Using a joystick, he manipulates the shots, zooming down, looking left or right, and panning up to the horizon.
You can see that the sky of Mars is more of a butterscotch color than a blue color or a pinkish red color. And all of this is visible once you put together the big picture from all those photos in the mosaic.
It's like playing around in Google Earth, except instead of jumping you from one address to the next, the cave is a smooth ride. Well, smooth-ish.
It's a bit dizzying.
Yes. There's actually a documented medical condition. There's a term cyber sickness that's used, and it's used to describe the dizzy, occasionally nauseating experience if you move too quickly through these virtual worlds.
At a more leisurely pace, you do get a pretty realistic taste for the landscapes. There's a constant urge to try to touch what's in front of you. The cave is housed inside Villanova's library and is the first on a college campus in the region. Companies across the country have been using this technology for a while. Designers will take a product in the developmental stage and render it for the screen. Architects and urban planners use caves to turn sketches into experiences to get a better sense of what the space would actually feel like.
Can people use this? Will it be lit well? Let's check it out in 3D first. but immersive 3D, not just on the screen, but immerse yourself. Say, oh yeah, this will work if you turn this into a physical reality.
He loads a virtual model of something that did just become a physical reality, a remodeled lounge and study area inside one of the buildings on Villanova's campus. We grabbed a freshman named Charles Wahlberg to give his opinion.
Wow. I'm really blown away by how, by how similar it looks to the room that I've actually been in before, and then B, just how, I guess, real it looks, how lifelike everything is.
Using the joystick, Wahlberg tools around the space, around the chairs and desks. He can actually pick them up using buttons to rearrange the seating. There's clear video game potential here, but also benefits for the heavier parts of college life.
You can read things and you can try to understand them that way by just reading a textbook, but I think you really learn best when you can visually understand something. And I think this does a great job of that, and it'll be a great learning tool.
Incorporating a cave experience into every class syllabus won't be immediate. Time and cost limit the creation of these virtual worlds. But Professor Klassner says he's been talking up cave technology with professors across the school.
We're going to be working with all of the different departments, academic departments at Villanova, from philosophy to physics, and asking, what do you need to make this work? What material do you need to use this in your classrooms?
How about a trip into the Double Helix for biology students? A tour of marshlands aimed at environmental sciences majors. Dim the lights, put on some funny glasses, and real-world applications become real. Sort of. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. It's time now for a science news update. Joining us is Carrie Gren. She is an associate editor for The Scientist. And in that role, she reads through a lot of new studies every week and keeps us posted on the latest developments. Her picks for today, the Rosetta mission and tracing the cat genome. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Maiken.
Let's start with the touchdown on a comet. Of course, there was a lot of excitement about this, but what does it all mean?
Right. So the Rosetta spacecraft launched its probe called Philae, and it touched down on a comet way out in outer space near Jupiter on Wednesday. We had a lot of excitement building around this because Rosetta has been out in space since 2004, and this is the first successful landing on a comet. And the goal of the mission is to drill into the comet to take pictures and other measurements. The Philae probe actually has a little chemistry lab on board, so it can do some analyses of the samples it takes. Scientists are very interested in the molecules on the interior of the comet, particularly water and organic molecules, which are the building blocks of life. So comets are the debris left over from when the solar system was first pulling itself together 4.5 billion years ago. And there's this idea that comets had smashed into the Earth way back when and brought some of these molecules to the planet, perhaps seeded the planet with the molecules that would go on to form life.
So this could really give us a better understanding of where we came from.
Right, exactly. The origins of life may be found within comets. And so now we have this Philae probe on the comet. They're gathering data already. It's been sending scientific data back to the researchers on this planet.
Now, it took 10 years roughly to get to this point. How long is this mission supposed to last?
It depends on the solar panels on the probe. If dust from the comet covers those up, then its life may only last a few days.
So Philae is not coming back to Earth, right?
No, Philae and Rosetta are not coming back to Earth. They will spin along with the comet out of the solar system eventually. The Rosetta mission is slated to last for about another year.
Now, Carrie, let's move on to your next pick, which is the cat genome. Untangling that was a big international effort.
It was, yes. It took a few years. And this latest paper looks into some of the genetic correlates of domestication. So cats became domesticated around 9 or 10,000 years ago. And it looks like several genes related to temperament and personality underwent some adjustments, perhaps not surprisingly. For example, there are a few mutations in genes related to aggressive behavior compared to cats' wild relatives. Other genes were related to fear, memory, reward learning, and this all makes sense. Cats are less fearful than their untamed counterparts. They're affectionate with humans. They're less aggressive. There were also changes related to cats' appearance, like their fur texture and their colors. Also not terribly surprising since humans breed animals for the way they look. But it was also neat. The researchers looked at cats' genomes compared to other animals, including dogs. They found genes explaining cats' ability to live off an extremely carnivorous diet and also their superior ability to sniff out pheromones and to see in low light and to hear really well.
We also know a lot more about similarities between cats and humans now, right? Because we're affected by some of the same afflictions and so on.
We do. So, you know, on its own, it's interesting to see the genetic signature of domestication, but to understand cats' genome also means to potentially understand human diseases that may have similar genetic underpinnings. And then, of course, any diseases that affect cats, because as our companion animals, that's important to us as well.
Carrie, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor for The Scientist and a regular contributor to The Pulse. Coming up on The Pulse, choosing your words wisely for medical reasons.
I think about, is it really worth telling that story? It's not worth it. It's going to hurt too much. Or I'll pay for it tomorrow.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse and believes that everyone should make the most of every moment. That's why they offer doctors and hospitals across the region and a range of health plans designed to meet your needs. More at IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations to increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. New research takes a radically different approach to cancer and describes it as sort of a safe mode for our cells when being attacked by an outside threat. Joining us now to talk about this idea is Paul Davies from Arizona State University in Tempe, who has led the team that put forth this pretty controversial idea. Paul Davies, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
It's my pleasure.
Now, let me ask you, you're trained in physics, so one might ask, why are you researching cancer?
You're as surprised as I am. this happened because I got a phone call about 7 or 8 years ago from Anna Barker, who was then deputy director of the National Cancer Institute. And to cut a long story short, she said something like, well, we're spending all this money on cancer research and we're stuck. Can physicists help, you see? So my response was, well, I don't know anything about cancer. And she said, that doesn't matter. So for me, it's a huge learning curve. I think I've wrapped my head around what the problem is, at least. And during this time, I've been developing a theory of cancer. You might think, well, surely after all this research and all this money's been spent and a million published papers, you could say, what is cancer? Why does it exist? How does it fit into the great story of life? And get an answer. Well, it turns out that you can't. What I've been trying to do is answer the question, what is cancer? Why does it exist in the first place? Pretty much all multicellular organisms get cancer. So if cancer is widespread in the biological world, that suggests it has very deep evolutionary roots. And you go back hundreds of millions. In fact, you go back over a billion years to the beginning of the story, which is the dawn of multicellularity. So for most of the history of life on Earth, which stretches back nearly 4 billion years, it was just microbes. And there's one imperative for a microbe, replicate, replicate, replicate. They are, in effect, immortal. But about 1.5 billion years ago, something extraordinary happened. Some microbes got together and formed a sort of union in which they began to cooperate. And the upshot of this was the most of the cells in that union outsource their immortality to specialized germ cells like sperm and ova, and the rest of the cells paid the price for that contract of programmed cell death. This has the frightening term apoptosis. And so in a human being, our cells, say your kidney or your liver or something, you get a few replication events, and then those cells are programmed to die. That requires layer upon layer of policing and regulation in these organisms to make sure it happens. And if something breaks down with that policing, cheating begins. And that cheating we call cancer.
So what is the role of cancer cells? What do they do that other cells don't do? And what are they supposed to do?
It's important to understand in biology that evolution builds on what was there before. And so cells come with a sort of core functionality, which goes back even before the multicellular world. And this core functionality we would regard as being rather selfish. That is, it's reverting to a type of behavior of survival at all costs. And all our cells have the same DNA. Most of our cells don't behave in this selfish manner. They stick to the rules because there's a whole policing arrangement to make sure that they behave themselves and do the right things and die when they're supposed to. But if something goes a little bit wrong, and in particular if a cell is threatened, and it doesn't have to be a carcinogen, it doesn't have to be a chemical agent or radiation, it could just be a poor tissue environment. As you get older, your tissues degenerate, and then that microenvironment affects the way your cells behave. And if they, to express it graphically, if they sort of feel uncomfortable or there's something going a bit wrong, then they have this inbuilt safe mode, as I'm calling it, that they can default back to. They can say, oh, I don't like this. I remember how life was 1.5 billion years ago. I will default back to that core functionality, which I know I can run, just like with a computer running on safe mode, and it goes back to that core functionality. It's a reversion or an atavism, a default back to an ancestral mode of behavior or an ancestral phenotype, to use the technical term.
So what would your model then suggest for potential treatments for cancer?
If I'm right that cancer's deep evolutionary roots can be traced back to the dawn of multicellularity 1.5 billion years ago, what do we know about planet Earth at that time? The one thing we do know is that it had very low levels of oxygen in the atmosphere. The organisms that were living at that time were living in a hypoxic world. And this fermentation process is ideally suited to a hypoxic world. It's what cancer likes. And so one way of tackling cancer is to make it feel uncomfortable in the modern world. That is to give it lots of oxygen and take away the one thing it needs to run fermentation, which is sugar. So one possible therapeutic implication of these ideas is to turn off the sugar and turn up the oxygen. That is to go on to a low sugar diet and have hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which is used for a wide variety of diseases. And until recently, nobody's thought about using it for cancer.
Now, let me ask you, what kinds of reactions have you gotten to this theory you put forth?
The reactions have been a little bit mixed, and I judge this to be about right. So among people working in mainstream biology, first of all, of course, they don't like physicists coming in from the outside and saying, you don't know what you're doing, you people. Obviously, that causes a certain amount of resentment. But then my reply to that is, well, the NCI is paying me to be disruptive. And so if I was just going to say, oh, yes, so I've rediscovered what you guys have known all along, well, that's no good, is it? So I don't mind that response. That's my job. But the second thing is that when I point out things, for example, like the connection with embryos or the Warburg effect, the oxygen story going back to the 1920s, they'll say, we know this, so what's new? I think the answer is, what is new is that the significance of these things has been shrugged aside. And the great virtue of bringing in people who are fresh pair of eyes, is that they look at these things, and I can look across the whole scientific landscape and collect all these sort of facts and try to weave them together, connect the dots in a novel way, to tell a different narrative about the same things, the things that cancer biologists will know about, but maybe don't see it in quite the same way as a physicist might.
Paul Davies, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Davies is a physicist researching cancer at Arizona State University in Tempe. And we talked for quite some time, Paul and I, about his interesting and controversial ideas. And if you want to listen to that whole conversation, go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always welcome your feedback. So if you have any questions or any response to what he said, send us an email at thepulse@whyy.org. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. This week, we hear from Leslie Handler. She talks about a life-saving decision she made to follow up on something found on her tongue during a routine dental checkup 20 years ago.
It was just a tiny little white spot, something called leukoplakia. All leukoplakia is it means white spot. But it could, over time, turn into precancerous something. And it could, over time, turn into cancerous something. I started, having it followed regularly, and it was still no big deal. It was frustrating, and it was annoying, and it was painful, but it wasn't cancer. Every time, it was benign. This went on for about 5 years. And eventually, one of them came back. It wasn't benign anymore. The first thing is you get scared out of your mind. And the second thing is you calm down and you ask a lot of questions. And, of course, you do the thing that probably no one should ever do. You go on the internet and you decide to be your own, doctor, which is always a mistake because, of course, you always lead yourself to the worst scenario that you could possibly lead yourself to. I had a lot of confidence in this oncologist, and his attitude was, at the time, we're going to take what we need to take and no more, but we're going to make sure we have clean margins. And, I imagine you'll have your speech back. I remember hearing the "I imagine" part. We had that first surgery and we went from there. And unfortunately, it just started a roller coaster for 15 more years until now, present time. It just kept coming back. We've done everything from just a spot on the tongue to the whole side of the tongue to it spread to the jaw of my mouth, the floor of my mouth. I've lost all the teeth on one side. And this last surgery, which was just this past July, it hit the tonsil. I've never had chemotherapy. I've never had radiation. Anytime I've ever asked the doctor about it, because I've had so many surgeries, the doctor's response to me was, well, we want to save radiation. When it gets really bad and you're desperate, you do radiation because you can only radiate the same spot one time. So we cut every time. I'm not good at a lot of things, and we all have our talents. The one thing I always felt I was good at was being a good communicator. Communication has definitely been a very big part of my life and a very big frustration since all this has happened. It's also sort of changed my personality a little bit, and I would call myself a gregarious introvert. I'm anything but shy, but I'm also can be very reserved because I think about, is it really worth telling that story? It's not worth it. It's going to hurt too much. Or I'll pay for it tomorrow. Email becomes my best friend. Texting, I was probably one of the first people my age to sign up. And I tend to kind of completely shut down for a while when I'm not able to speak at all because it's too frustrating to me not being able to say what I wanted whenever I wanted. I have a wonderful family. I have a lot of great things in my life. And I feel that if you don't have a little suffering, a little pain in your life, it's very hard to learn compassion. And I don't think I would be as compassionate of a person that I hope that I am if this hadn't happened to me. I don't think I'd be as appreciative of the things that I have
the people who love me in my life and the people whom I love. And very grateful for an overly zealous dentist I went to see 20 years ago.
Leslie Handler talking about her experience with tongue cancer. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. Leslie has written an essay about how public speaking has helped her cope with her illness, and you can read that at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website at whyy.org/thepulse. And we always, always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.